So the Housing Finance and Policy Committee will come to order. I would like to announce that this meeting will take place via House Rule 10.01. The clerk will take the roll.
Houseman?
Present.
Howard?
Present.
Tice? Tice? Agbaje?
Present.
Bliss?
Present.
Gomez?
Present.
Hassan?
Present.
Heinrich?
Present.
Herr?
Present.
Jurgens?
Present.
Olson?
Present.
Farr?
Present.
And Ryer?
Present.
And that is it, Madam Chair.
And Mr. Wilcox, is a quorum present?
A quorum is present, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Next order of business is the approval of minutes from Thursday, January 14. Representative Howard, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
I have, and I'll move the minutes.
Are there any comments about the content of the minutes? If not, members, we can approve this motion by voice vote. So please unmute yourselves. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Members, this week we're going to hear from a number of our partners in housing work. Today, a number of nonprofits that I have spent a number of years working with, and I think you will appreciate getting to know them as well. And then on Thursday, we'll hear from governmental entities and their role in housing efforts. So we're not alone in this. There are a lot of people working with us. We are going to hear first from Common Bond. Deirdre Schmidt is the president and CEO. And I will welcome you to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, representatives. My name is Deirdre Schmidt, and I'm the president and CEO at Common Bond Communities.
And I should just mention, members, Mr. Wirth sent out an email with a number of attachments that have the handouts for today. Continue.
Great. Well, again, thank you for hearing from us today about nonprofits in affordable housing. It's a wide variety. Just as you wouldn't compare a profit-motivated enterprise like a corner lemonade stand to a Coca-Cola Corporation, there is a wide range of nonprofits, size, mission, service area, et cetera. But the nonprofits that you'll hear from today are highly professional organizations with experienced staff, long track records, quality real estate, and really innovative financial and social service programs. The transactions that we participate in are among the most complicated in real estate. And I can tell you, because I've done high-end condo development, office retail, I assure you that the modest housing that we build is a masterclass with many financial players, strict parameters for the use of federal and state resources, challenges in getting entitlements in the face of community resistance, high expectations, because we're often marrying many community agendas together. Community revitalization and economic development, historic preservation, fighting gentrification, providing deepest affordability for those with the lowest incomes. High level of eligibility compliance. And also, you'll hear from many of us how we serve the non-bricks and mortar, the non-shelter, the human side of need for populations that have significant barriers to obtaining housing in the market. Evictions on their records, criminal histories, mental, chemical, or physical health challenges, but also an important subsection of the workforce that isn't well served by the market, but we all know is really essential to our economy. So I'm spending a couple minutes to give you these general insights into how we work. Our governance as nonprofits, our governance and management isn't designed for personal enrichment. So our nonprofit corporations are organized around serving a public purpose and relieving a burden of government. So no person or persons owns a nonprofit. We cannot raise equity from the sale of ownership interests as some for-profit organizations do. And our boards of directors are volunteers who bring technical expertise and community perspective in oversight of the strategy, the finance, and the operational management of our organizations. Sometimes folks believe that nonprofit organizations aren't profitable. But particularly for those like us who are engaged in the highly complicated and capital-intensive development of housing, we do need to generate resources. In fact, none of the organizations you'll hear from today would be credible to lenders and investors in the complicated deals and financial transactions that we're doing without putting up a surplus each year, or at least in many years, so that the resources that we earn or that are contributed to us are greater than what we need to operate in that one single year. So the contributions that we're allowed to take that are often but not always tax deductible, combined with the income that we can earn from some but not all of our activities, are available to us to internally subsidize the non-profitable parts of our business. It also helps us save for rainy days when we have, which is a part of good business stewardship and which got a lot of us through this last year. We don't all pay all of the taxes that for-profit organizations do, but we do pay many of them, like payroll tax. And some nonprofits even pay income tax. For instance, Common Bond has taxable income from our property management activities. In sum, our after-tax profitability is important to nonprofits, but the magnitude of the surplus that we seek and what we do with those profits is fundamentally different. The final general point I'll make is that as nonprofits, we don't have a corner on the market of being purpose-driven or of making decisions that are based on things other than just profitability. Many for-profit organizations are led by those who care about the communities in which they operate. But we as nonprofits are specifically engineered to do different things and to do things differently. And I've had the opportunity to work all around the country and around the world, actually, in housing. And the healthiest housing ecosystems are those where nonprofits, for-profits, and government work together with clear goals. So now I'll talk a little bit about Common Bond. What is now called Common Bond Communities was formed in 1971. By people of faith who had just lived through the turbulent 1960s, times that feel in some ways like those we're in today, where the peace of our cities were in peril. And they thought it wasn't enough to just talk about the root causes of the distress in their communities, the racial and economic inequities. They didn't want to just talk about it in church on Sunday. They wanted to do something about it. And so they decided that that housing was the single best investment in both the individual, so the opportunity for all people, but also the health of our cities and our society for successive generations. And so Common Bond started building housing, not just in the inner city, but also in suburban and smaller communities. So Common Bond now owns homes in almost 60 cities in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Iowa. In fact, we have housing communities in 50 Minnesota congressional districts. Minnesota is our center of gravity with 80% of our housing here. We property manage all but a couple of our housing communities ourselves. This was a lesson that we learned early on because the relationship that a landlord and tenant have can be a very difficult one, and it's fraught with a power imbalance. We attempt to take a pro-resident approach wherever we can. And so self-management is important to us. Common Bond was also one of the earliest organizations to move to serve the social needs, not just the shelter needs of residents. Through our Advantage Services and our Advantage Service Centers, we focus first and foremost on housing stability. And what I mean by that is when a resident would otherwise be in a position where they might have their housing threatened through eviction, we are there. It can be job loss, dissolution of a marriage, whatever it happens to be, we attempt to be an assist to a resident in that situation. A study in Hennepin County showed that Common Bond was successful in avoiding evictions, having the lowest eviction activity in absolute terms and relative to the size of our portfolio. We have three other areas of focus for our social services. Advantage services around education and advancement. For kids, this looks like programs that start with the kids farthest behind relative to grade level, moving them forward with the help of a caring adult. For older kids, it's helping them get through high school and graduate. In our last cohort, we had 100% graduation rate. For adults, it's finding the best job they can possibly secure and then laddering their career. We also focus on health and wellness. This is primarily focused on seniors, who make up about a third of our population. These are very low income and low asset seniors, many of whom have only Social Security income and something under $5,000 in assets. We want to help them live with dignity and as long as possible independently. So we focus on physical health and balance, social engagement and connectedness. And the final focus area of our social services is community engagement. And by that, we mean engagement with one another, neighbors within a housing community, with neighbors around a housing community, and in the greater civic realm. In fact, some of you may have heard from a Common Bond resident at a previous hearing on housing or transportation through the work we do with our Common Bond Advocacy Responders Group. This is all a reflection of the fact that we try to do more than just create housing, manage that housing, and provide direct social services. We want to help influence the systems in which we operate to be more equitable and just. So, for example, Common Bond did a first of its kind study on housing stability and eviction prevention with the help of Ernst & Young. They determined that for every dollar we invest in housing stability, society saves $4 in a pretty immediate return. So in this spirit, we seek to be a resource to those of you who have the responsibility of policy and funding decisions. Thanks for the opportunity today, and feel free to call on us at any time in the future.
And just to clarify, one of the statistics I may have misunderstood, you said you had housing in 50 congressional districts, but then I thought you said in Minnesota. Did you mean legislative districts?
Sorry. House districts.
Okay, in Minnesota.
Minnesota.
And we should also mention that I think Common Bond is the largest housing nonprofit in the Midwest. Am I correct?
Well, it depends on the cohort you put us in. We are the largest in our type, basically, of housing service providers in the upper Midwest.
Mr. Wirth, are there questions?
Madam Chair, there are no questions in the queue at this time.
Okay. Thank you very much. This is very helpful, and now we'll see the context of this nonprofit along with some others. So again, thank you, Ms. Schmidt, for the presentation, and we now welcome Lee Blons, who's President and CEO of Beacon Interfaith Housing Collaborative. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you so much. I'm Lee Blons. I'm the CEO and President of Beacon Interfaith Housing Collaborative.
I've had the good fortune to work with Beacon on a number of projects.
Yes, thank you so much, Madam Chair and representatives. We really appreciate the opportunity to share some information with you today. I'd like to start with just a few highlights of Beacon and where we fit within the continuum of housing development. And then I'd like to focus on the scale of the need and the tremendous gap in resources. Beacon is a collaborative of 100 congregations, churches, synagogues, and mosques in the Twin Cities that have come together to create deeply affordable and supportive homes for those that are most negatively impacted in our current housing system. Our vision is that all people have a home. In addition to developing homes, Beacon has become one of the leaders in advancing more equitable housing policy and investment. When we talk about affordable housing as a community, we often gloss over the nuances of what that full spectrum means. There's a housing continuum from emergency shelter to supportive housing with trauma-informed care services for those who were experiencing homelessness, to deeply affordable housing for those that are extremely low income. When in housing speak, we often call 30% area median income. Here in the Twin Cities, that's around $30,000 for a family of four. It's much lower in other parts of the state. Into workforce rental, which is usually defined by nonprofits as 50% area median income, once again, around $50,000 here in the Twin Cities, and then affordable home ownership. Minnesotans need that full spectrum of affordable housing. Beacon focuses on our supportive housing for those coming out of homelessness or other deeply affordable housing for those making less than $30,000 a year. It's a pretty unique niche that Beacon has, and we are one of the leading developers of supportive housing in Minnesota. We currently have around 200 supportive housing units for formerly chronically homeless adults with chemical dependency and mental illness, with another 6,400 homes being added to those developments with recent financing from the state. Last year, we opened Great River Landing, the first major supportive housing development, 72 units focused on those leaving prison. We are also the largest provider of youth housing with 125 homes in three locations, St. Paul, Minneapolis, and Edina. We currently have under development 135 homes for formerly homeless families in four locations, Minneapolis, Hopkins, Plymouth, and Shakopee. Beacon collaborates with service providers to provide the trauma-informed and culturally specific services for our residents. We're grateful to work with YouthLink, Better Futures Minnesota, the YMCA, Simpson Housing, and Avivo. Given the disproportionate impact of homelessness on African-American neighbors in the Twin Cities, the majority of our residents in our supportive housing are African-American. With a partnership with Red Lake that began in 2018 with the Wall of Forgotten Natives, we're pleased to share we also have a growing number of Native residents and that one of our new developments, Bimo Seda, just Ojibwe for Let's Walk Together, will begin construction in the next few months. Let me transition now to the unmet need in our community, and I'll have a PowerPoint follow along with me. There's a general acceptance that families can sustain their housing and have enough money for other basic needs if they pay 30% or less of their income. As a married professional, I've done the math, and I pay 18% of my income for my housing, just to put that in perspective. What may be shocking to you is that there are over 130,000 households in Minnesota paying more than 50%, not just over 30% of their income, but more than 50% of their income each month, struggling to pay their rent or their mortgage. The numbers I'm showing you are before COVID. And so, of course, not surprising, those that are the lowest income at that 30% area median income or lower are those most likely to be in that situation. It is an issue that disproportionately impacts families of color. One in five families that are white have this issue. But one in three Native or Black families have this issue of non-affordable rent. This is not a metro issue. The red counties are where more than 20% of all renters are paying more than 50% of their income. These are families on the brink of homelessness each month, one car repair, one illness away from losing their home. What can the state do to create deeply affordable and supportive housing? It requires capital, supportive services, and rent. First of all, I want to thank you for what you've already done. The bipartisan support for housing infrastructure bonds has been hugely impactful. Of the homes that Beacon has developed or are under development right now, over 300 have been, have been hugely impactful. Of the homes that Beacon has developed or are under development, 300 were financed with housing infrastructure bonds. We're pleased that under the Waltz administration and Commissioner Ho, there's increased emphasis on deeply affordable and supportive housing. Just this December, the funds distributed by Minnesota Housing Finance and either coming from the federal government as low-income housing tax credits or from the HIB authorized by the legislature, 30% of those funds were focused on the deeply affordable 30% area median income households in Minnesota. This is a great increase from previous years in which only about 15 to 20% of housing capital resources were distributed in that way. Although services are usually the purview of other committees, I'd like to touch on this because the siloing of departments and funding creates challenges for those of us on the ground. It's our understanding that there's some discussion happening between Minnesota Housing and DHS about creating a flexible pot that could be allocated during the housing development process so that when you got a capital award, you could also get a services award to serve people who are chronically homeless. This would be hugely beneficial and encourage more supportive housing development. It is hard for organizations like Beacon that want to do more supportive housing to identify the service funding. Their skeleton thin funding for single adults with mental illness or chemical dependency, and we're concerned with the planned state cuts of 50% of flexible funding that's supposed to be replaced by new Medicaid funding. Even before cuts, this funding is not robust enough to support the deeper trauma-informed and culturally specific services that we believe our residents would benefit from. I do want to say we're deeply grateful for the Homeless Youth Act, which provides $12 million of flexible funding throughout the state, including the trauma-informed services at our homes to help young people be successful in housing, jobs, and education. But there's no designated funding for homeless families, and especially for the children that may not qualify for disability services, but need special attention to catch up with their peers after the trauma of homelessness. There are exciting models of supportive housing for families under child protection that could stop the removal of children that disproportionately impacts Native and Black families, but we need additional funding to provide the trauma-informed services. I'd like to call your attention to the missing pillar of funding, which is rent subsidy. Only one in four Minnesotans get the federal rent subsidy in which they income qualify for. Bring It Home Minnesota, that's authored by Michael Howard and 19 other co-authors, would end homelessness and housing instability tomorrow if the state made this investment. Just imagine the impact on residents, on their education and healthcare and employment if we all had a stable home. We're not planning to vaccinate only 25% of the population because that's all we can afford. We need to start designing housing policy starting with what it will take for all Minnesotans to have a stable home. Rent subsidy can be scaled quickly. Most people already live in a home. It's just that they need a little help to stretch their paycheck. We need to scale the solution to the scale of the problem. Next slide. Right now, less than half of 1% of the state budget goes to housing. We estimate that an increase to 4% of the state budget would provide housing stability to all Minnesotans. It's not easy, but it is simple. Thank you.
Madam Chair, you are muted right now.
Sorry. I wanted to particularly commend Beacon for one thing that you regularly do, and that is I have a constituent who worries that none of our affordable housing that we're building has three or four bedroom homes, which are necessary for some of the larger families, particularly in the immigrant community. And Beacon has a number of projects where that is specifically what you have done, that you are still thinking about three and four bedroom homes. So thank you very much for that. Mr. Wirth, do we have any questions?
Madam Chair, there are no questions in the queue at this time.
Thank you very much. So we will move on then to Lutheran Social Service, Jamie Stampley. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Jamie Stampley. Thank you, Madam Chair and community members. I'm so thankful for the opportunity to talk with you today.
Just for the record, you are the Senior Director of Housing Services, I believe.
That is correct.
Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. My name is Jamie Stampley, and I am the Senior Director of Housing Services for Lutheran Social Service Minnesota. Joining me via virtually Zoom is my colleague, Social Justice Advocate Paul Schlack, who will fill in for me in the event that I should have technical difficulties or need backup in this wonderful world of technology. LSS, as many like to call us, is one of the largest and oldest human service nonprofits in Minnesota, employing more than 2,300 individuals and engaging with over 10,000 volunteers. Every year, LSS has the opportunity to connect with 1 in 65 Minnesotans across all 87 counties, providing critical services to older adults, people with disabilities, children, youth, and families. Lutheran Social Services provides housing services across the entire state, and these services are designed to meet the specific needs of family, children and youth, people with disabilities, and people exiting correctional facilities. Today, I'm going to focus on my portfolio, which covers families services typically, with some single adults, some veteran work across the following regions: the 7-county metro area, St. Cloud, Brainerd and Central Minnesota, and to mention a few of the counties there. LSS Housing Services embraces the mission of preventing and ending homelessness in our community through acts of service, and we are passionate about meeting families where they are and supporting them in their goals of housing stability. On any given night, many of you are aware that there's more than 10,000 individuals experiencing homelessness across the state. This year in our department, we served 1,127 of those individuals. Those are children and adults from 431 households. 89% of the households we served were people of color. People of color are highly overrepresented in our statistics, and LSS has made a mission to better represent a racial equity lens in our work, addressing the underlying causes like structural and racial inequities. And by doing so, we're changing our policies and programs to reflect that work. We are also including and focusing on families with lived experience and their voice by conducting and creating a lived experience advisory board. This advisory board is comprised of homeless or formerly homeless individuals, and they have the opportunity to advance their goals identified by their voice, and we are bringing them to the platform. We use that advisory board to help us with hiring, with policy change, and also to just give us constructive feedback on what is working with them in our programs, as well as the shelter system, as well as community linkages across the state. We believe that this is imperative to a successful program implementation, ending homelessness, and ensuring our programming is better centered and beneficial to the ones that we serve. We join the state in the mission stating that we can end homelessness if everyone plays a critical role. Most of our funders are federal, state, church, and philanthropic dollars, and we use those funds to create programming for the families that we serve. LSS is unique in the fact that we provide services for families in our site-based programs, which are programs that we own and that we operate throughout the state of Minnesota, but we also collaborate with many entities to provide supportive housing programs through services. Those programs are subsidy administration, which, again, as some of the colleagues have mentioned, families pay 30% of their income towards rent. And then the other part are developers who are building affordable housing. They do the property or the bricks and mortar, and LSS comes in and partners with them and provides the services to families there so that the operation is successful. We work with collaboration and have the opportunity to work with staff to achieve goals related to housing, family life, income, and many other areas. We interact with families in their homes and a home-based program because we believe that that is cornerstone of our work. I'm going to also highlight some of the services later on that we provide in those services. Through case management services, we're working in a two-generational approach, sometimes three and four-generational. We have lots of families who parenting, grandparents parenting, aunts and uncles parenting, those kind of things. Our case management services are trauma-informed. They're individualized and strength-based, meeting with the families from shelter all the way into housing till they obtain their keys. We also work primarily with eviction prevention. Eviction prevention, we believe that keeping families when possible in their current housing situation is imperative. We also believe a core component of that is working with landlords. Landlords have a voice in the homeless specter where they feel like sometimes their voice had been silent. So we have really worked to engage landlords to how can we support them as well in this work? So we have Landlord Engagement Series, which is a program called Rent Ed, which is a virtual series that landlords can attend via classroom video, and they get a credit off of their rental license and some property tax savings where it's applicable in their counties. This gives landlords a backing. We also meet with landlords quarterly to just sort of on any platform that they desire that they would like to hear. So a lot of times it's legal aid, mediation services, home improvement resources to landlords so that they can continue to do the work. With the vacancy rate right now in Minnesota at 1.2%, we believe it's vital to engage and retain landlords so that people have a place to go. Families that we work often have multiple barriers to housing, with evictions on their record, some criminal barriers, and landlords can often say no to them. So with our relationships with landlords, we'd create an environment where they can say yes in partnership with working with us, and we've been very successful. We also do a tenant education series to families. We work on improving their credit rental history reports. So from the day that they come in, we're working on their credit, increasing and maximizing all of their benefits as far as economic stability. Maybe that means obtaining a job. Maybe that means applying for Social Security. Maybe that just means maximizing their food budget by community linkages, knowing where their food shelf is in their community. Case managers do a specific curriculum with those families in that arena. Housing stability always is our goal. At any time we are working with landlords and tenants about how can I be a good renter? How can I stay in my place? How can I pay my rent on time? What happens if I'm in a crisis? Where can I go? We work on those. A lot of the families that we come to, they come from us with multiple barriers, fleeing domestic violence, open child protection cases, physical, mental, and chemical health issues, chronic homelessness, and poverty. We meet all of those areas in assessment and work with assessment with the family from the day they enter our services to the day they end. Families typically stay with us for 5 to 10 years, depending on what criteria they enter in, and we work in three buckets. So I'm going to talk a little bit, move into transition about those that we serve. As I mentioned before, we work in prevention. That's the key part, rental assistance, work with landlords and landlord engagement. We also work with rapid rehousing and transitional housing programs. Those are short-term, medium-touch assistance that includes small financial assistance, time-limited funds, and includes case management and housing supports services with our housing specialist. We also work in permanent supportive housing. Those are the hardest to hard serve families in Minnesota. Those are families that are chronically homeless, been homeless for long or multiple periods of time, and families with multiple barriers that I talked about before. Those families tend to need the most high intensity level of services and tend to stay with us the longest. We're also working across the state of Minnesota with many developers who are developing more housing units, working with them from the ground up when they start building, asking them to commit to serving at least 10 families in their housing development. So it's mixed compound. So you're going to have people from private market rate as well as families exiting homelessness in one building. We provide case management services and also services to the property managers there at those properties. We have over 17 of those collaborations across the state. We are a team of professionals from various backgrounds and specialties. We work with children's services, parenting support, and we do all of those with the children in our two generational programs. We have lots of after school time, tutoring, work with school social workers. We know that children that are exiting homelessness are falling behind their peers. So we work with the school in collaboration with wraparound services to ensure that the children are getting the services that they need as well. We believe that in order to be successful in housing support for all families, it needs to be affordable, include services, and has strong collaboration with the community partners across the state.
Are you near conclusion?
Yes. LSSM embraces the mission of preventing and ending homelessness in our community through acts of service, and we appreciate your efforts in joining us in that fight.
Oh, you were near. You were near. And did Mr. Stock have anything to add, or was he there as standby?
Madam Chair, this is Paul Slack, and yes, I am here for standby, so I have nothing to add. So thank you very much.
Mr. Wirth, do we have questions?
Madam Chair, nothing in the queue right now.
Okay. Thank you very much. That was an amazing collection of services provided. I'm hoping people all over the state of Minnesota know you exist and know how to access these services. We now have Twin Cities Habitat for Humanity, Greta Goetz, Policy and Advocacy Manager. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Hausman. My name is Greta Goetz, and I am the Policy and Advocacy Manager at Twin Cities Habitat. No worries. I'm just going to share a quick PowerPoint. All right, is that showing up?
Not yet.
Okay. Sorry about that.
If we were in the committee room, we could have a staff person helping you.
Yes. Great. All right. Twin Cities Habitat for Humanity brings people together to create, preserve, and promote affordable homeownership and advance racial equity in housing. We are the largest nonprofit affordable homeownership developer in the Twin Cities. Since 1985, we have created more than 1,500 affordable homes for local families. These homes impact thousands of children, stabilize neighborhoods, and boost the economic vitality of the region. Homeownership is the single most transformational way to address systemic inequality. The benefits of a stable home ripple into every area of a family's life. Not only does homeownership have long-term positive impacts on health and education, it is the primary way that families build wealth and pass it on to future generations. Habitat is successful thanks to thousands of donors, supporters, and volunteers. We are part of a network of Habitat affiliates across the state, and we work in coalition with Homeownership Minnesota and Homes for All to advance policy solutions across the entire housing continuum. The housing crisis might look different throughout the state, but the lack of affordable housing impacts every community in Minnesota. Minnesota's housing challenges disproportionately impact families of color. Minnesota has one of the highest rates of homeownership in the country, and we should be proud of that. But what we can't be proud of is that we also have one of the widest gaps in homeownership based on race. These disparities have deep roots in policies like racial covenants and redlining, which historically denied homeownership to families of color. In order to ensure that more families can access the benefits of homeownership and build generational wealth, we have to be as intentional about solving these disparities as we were in creating them. Twin Cities Habitat is committed to closing the racial disparity in homeownership. In recent years, 85% of our new home buyers have been families of color. We partner with families making up to 80% of area median income to buy homes. Habitat families have purchased homes in 64 cities across the metro area. And in a given year, at least half of our clients buy homes in suburban communities, and about half buy in Minneapolis or St. Paul. Home buyers can buy a home that we build from the ground up with volunteers or a home that we've rehabbed. We leverage public funding through sources like the Challenge Program to develop these opportunities for home buyers. Additionally, home buyers can use our affordable mortgage to buy a home for sale on the open market. These clients work with a realtor to find a home that they love anywhere in the 7-county metro area. With the new open market approach, we've been able to double the number of home buyer families that we partner with each year. Every Habitat homebuyer has a monthly mortgage payment set at 30% of their income. Our clients are prepared for long-term success with one-on-one financial coaching, homeownership education classes, and post-purchase support. State resources like the Homeownership Education Counseling and Training Program, or HECAT, help provide these services. Homeownership education is a proven model that works, and we maintain an annual foreclosure rate of less than 1%. In addition to creating new homeownership opportunities, we work to preserve the affordable homes that families already own. Our A Brush With Kindness home repair program provides critical health safety modifications to help families stay in their homes. This year, we're advocating to increase cap amounts on the rehab loan and emergency loan program so that these programs better stabilize homeowners with significant repair needs. Many Habitat homeowners are on the front lines of the COVID-19 pandemic. We've heard from 1 in 5 of our Habitat homeowners that they are concerned about making their mortgage payments. And we have done everything we can to be flexible with homeowners facing challenges. We've placed a priority on keeping families in their homes and preventing foreclosure. We've added mortgage forbearance and loan modification options. We helped families access mortgage assistance when CHOP was available to new homeownership opportunities throughout the pandemic. There is still a significant need for additional housing assistance from the state, and these dollars must be eligible for homeowners. Families simply can't afford to lose a home that they have worked so hard to buy, and our economy cannot afford another foreclosure crisis like we saw in 2008. We are determined to protect a family's greatest asset at this time, their home, and we need your support to do so. Just as Habitat partners with the corporate, faith, and philanthropic community, we rely on state government to help further our mission. Investing in programs like Challenge, HECAT, the emergency loan and rehab loan, and housing assistance for homeowners will help us continue our work to create and preserve affordable homes and prepare homebuyers for success. A safe and stable home is more important than ever before. It takes all of us working together to build a stronger and more equitable state for generations to come. We look forward to working with you to ensure that all families have access to the transformational power of homeowners. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It is helpful to have the follow-up, and not just after they're in their homes, but to keep that stability. I think that's such an important role to play. Mr. Wirth, do we have questions?
Madam Chair, Representative Agbaje has a question.
Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you so much, Ms. Goetz. I appreciate the presentation. I did have a question, just kind of if you could speak a little bit more to the types of homeowners assistance that you guys are providing, any type of technical assistance with mortgages, finances, things like that. Because as you said, I do think it's vitally important that we're also looking at preventing a foreclosure crisis, as we're also concerned and worried about the upcoming eviction crisis that could happen.
Ms. Gates?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for your question. So we do have an ongoing foreclosure prevention program that's been open to homeowners in the Twin Cities before COVID. But since COVID-19 hit, we've included a significant number of new loan modification and forbearance options for our clients. So we've put our Habitat-held mortgages into a forbearance, so folks are not paying on their mortgages at this time if they're facing challenges. However, we're also helping homeowners access housing assistance when it becomes available. So when the COVID-19 housing assistance program was available over about the last 6 months, that's something that we helped Habitat homeowners and other homeowners access in order to pay for their mortgages. And now, as CHOP kind of wound up, we're looking to see if there are going to be any additional state resources that are put into housing assistance so that there are opportunities for homeowners to access that. We've been hearing about this new federal program that's provided rental assistance, and so we're hoping to work with MHFA around how we can advocate for new dollars that could go into housing assistance that's available for things like mortgages, utilities, et cetera, for homeowners.
Follow-up, Representative?
Yeah, thank you so much, Madam Chair.
And I think to that question, this latest federal bill is all for rental assistance and none for homeownership. And so I think that means the state is going to have to take that seriously and step up and fill that gap. No further questions. Ms. Gates, do you have any closing comments?
I do not. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much for being with us. And now we have a Project for Pride in Living, Mike Lefebvre, Senior Vice President of Housing Stability. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am Mike Lefebvre. I'm the Senior Vice President for Housing Stability at Project for Pride and Living. And members of the committee, thank you so much for having me here today. And thank you for taking the time to talk with and listen to housing providers, those of us who are on the ground doing the work. I really appreciate it. Appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today. For those not familiar with PPL, PPL is a nonprofit that was founded in 1972 that is really focused on building the hope, assets, self-reliance of individuals and families who have lower incomes by, number one, providing transformational affordable housing, and number two, providing employment readiness services. We touch about 13,000 people every year through our programming, so our reach in the metro area is substantial. We fundamentally, as an organization, believe that the most effective way to promote long-term self-reliance is by stabilizing the economics of a household. We know that when we stabilize a household economically, we set the stage for long-term success. And so, like all of the other organizations you are hearing from today, we fundamentally believe that stable housing sets the stage for economic stability, for the successful provision of stable health care, and for educational stability. As a housing provider, PPL has developed, owned, and manages more than 1,600 units of affordable housing across the Twin Cities metropolitan area. Our service area is limited to the metro, but we're very deliberate and thoughtful about developing and providing housing in both urban and suburban locations. About half of our portfolio serves working and individuals and families and is affordable at 50 to 60% of the area median income. And about half of our portfolio is supportive housing, affordable at less than 30% of area median income, and is reserved for individuals and families impacted by homelessness, disability, chemical dependency, mental illness. We have staff that work closely with these residents to help them overcome barriers and achieve stability. At PPL, we track 24-month stability in our housing because we believe it is at that point, being stable in housing for 24 months, that things really begin to change for a household and stabilize across the dimensions I mentioned earlier, economic, health, educational. We're proud that more than 93% of our residents achieve 24-month housing stability. But I think my colleagues here have done a really nice job of explaining why affordable housing is important and the role it plays keeping our communities stable. They've also done a really nice job of giving you a sense of the complexity and multiple components associated with developing and maintaining affordable housing. I'm going to use just the rest of my time here to echo a few points on what we think the state can do based on our experience to help amplify and support our work on the ground. First, as I think we all understand, there is a dramatic shortage of affordable housing in our state, in our region. We at PPL believe we need more capital in our environment to expedite production. Housing infrastructure bonds have been a really important ingredient in this regard, and PPL is very supportive of expanding the availability of housing infrastructure bonds. Secondly, we believe supportive services are critical to keep people stable in their housing. We therefore think, you know, and Lee did a really nice job of talking about the difficulty of securing funding for services, and we think it is critically important to be thoughtful about enhancing rather than diminishing programs like housing supports. Even as Medicaid funding for services becomes available, in order that we not erode the long-term funding for services over time. So PPL is very supportive of maintaining and growing housing supports and increasing the provider rate for housing supports. Thirdly, in our experience, operating costs for affordable housing projects are relatively high compared to other multifamily buildings. because they require higher level of staffing, services, and maintenance to ensure the support and dignity of our residents. Recently, property tax pressures have been a challenge to our ability to properly staff and reinvest in the maintenance of our properties at PPL. And we believe property tax relief through simplifying and lowering the 4D class rates for affordable properties would provide critical supports to ensure quality operation and preservation for affordable housing for us and other providers like us. Lastly, I would say that COVID has put very real strain on our residents and our properties. We anticipate that will continue to be a very real issue into 2021, and we believe it's really extremely important for both our residents and our properties to continue to have well-designed rental support programs available. So just want to close by saying how much I appreciate this committee's attention and commitment to affordable housing in our state, and I really appreciate your time and interest this morning. Happy to take any questions if there are any.
Thank you very much. Mr. Wirth, do we have questions?
Madam Chair, none in the queue at this time.
Okay. Thank you very much. We appreciate your being with the committee this morning. And then finally, we have Catholic Charities. Wendy Underwood is the Vice President of the Social Justice Advocacy and Engagement. Welcome to the committee. We are happy to have you.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair and members. Thank you so much for this invitation. And for the record, I am Wendy Underwood with Catholic Charities of St. Paul in Minneapolis. I am going to test my Zoom skills and run just a few slides while also sharing some comments. And you have these slides in your packet as well. Oops. Thank you so much. Just briefly, a brief overview. Catholic Charities of St. Paul in Minneapolis, we are a 501c3 nonprofit that is separate from other Catholic charities. We greatly appreciate our partners, but we are our own entity. I find that helpful to clarify. We are a housing emergency shelter and direct services provider focused on achieving housing stability outcomes for those most in need. Advancing racial equity and social justice is also a part of our mission. We do this across 18 sites in Hennepin and Ramsey County, the total of over 500 team members. In 2020, we served over 23,000 men, women, children, and families, which includes over 500,000 nights of housing and shelter, and with over 900 apartments and four shelter locations. I'm going to talk a little bit more about those. Over that year, we served more than a million meals largely through the great support of tens of thousands of volunteer hours, and the majority of our financial support is private. This is a map, and you have this in your packets as well, that shows the locations of our sites. We operate, I mentioned, four emergency shelters, two for single adults, one for families, and one for youth. We operate three locations specific to Minnesotans with chronic substance abuse disorders. We operate a variety of permanent supportive housing sites. And then we have Hope Street, which is our program, both emergency shelter, transitional, and permanent housing for older youth, and the Northside Child Care Development Center, which is our four-star parent-aware rated amazing child care center in Minneapolis. I can't miss an opportunity with this committee to recognize our project currently in development. Thanks in great part to the very bipartisan, very strong support for housing infrastructure bonds, we were able to close on our new project, Exodus 2.0, just in December. This site in Minneapolis will more than double our current capacity in permanent housing for adults who are medically frail. This site will also have a wonderful collaboration with Healthcare for the Homeless, with 30 rooms for recuperative care and a community clinic. We're also moving all of our administrative offices and our Aging and Disability Services division to this site. So we are all going to be in one location, which is very exciting. So that just closed and is a direct recipient of Housing Infrastructure Bonds. And then finally, and before I just transition into a few talking points, you know, I love this committee and I'm so grateful for it. And I want to just acknowledge, particularly as a service provider of both shelters and housing and other supportive services, the real opportunity that you have as a committee to build critical bridges between all of these entities and between the committees that your colleagues sit on. It's just is a really great opportunity. There's a great opportunity to really understand the resources available for a person experiencing homelessness to be able to afford an apartment. It's complicated, and you have a chance to really understand that and advocate for it. As we've heard today, of course, ensuring that our state is on track in providing deeply affordable housing units, and that the state is recognizing the role shelters play in the full housing continuum and the need for state support. And then importantly, promoting the additional wraparound services that are very, very often needed for a person to really achieve those housing stability outcomes, which you've also heard about today. So I mentioned these slides are in your packet. I'm going to just stop sharing and just share a few more comments. I just need to pull up my slides. So I mentioned that we operate just over 900 apartments across the Twin Cities. And again, many of them built with your support for Housing Infrastructure Bonds. Supporting the operations of those sites is something I'd love to come back and talk with you about someday. The majority of our renters are recipients of housing support, which is a program Mike LaFave just mentioned. Housing support is a program benefiting seniors and adults with disabilities who have low incomes and who are at risk of homelessness or institutional placement. Housing support helps pay for housing costs, including rent, utilities, food, and household supplies, and in some cases, additional health services. The things that are beyond the four walls that a person needs to achieve housing stability. Other presenters today mentioned these critical beyond the four walls needs as well. It's really important to know that private landlords can accept housing support for a person's rent. It's not just service providers like us. And this is something that we would love to help grow. And while housing support is funded through the Department of Human Services, it is a direct link across this committee's commitment to improving access to housing affordability, and ending homelessness. I mentioned that we also manage four emergency shelters. And as you build this committee, I really ask that you think about the full housing continuum and the role emergency shelters play. I'm very excited for the Preventing Homelessness Division and all of the opportunities there, because shelters are really misunderstood. Shelters can provide an incredible opportunity for a person if we as a state recognize shelters as being a part of the full housing continuum, as well as a front line to our healthcare system, because that's what we do. That's what happens in shelters. When a person comes to us in need, shelters provide a safe space to sleep, a warm meal, and an opportunity to find a more stable place to stay, and very oftentimes the healthcare that person needs. Many of you have visited our Dorothy Day campus, just blocks from the Capitol, and I am able to have like one person at a time to walk around on a private tour if you're interested, and then someday we'd love to host the committee there again. Before COVID, our emergency shelter on that campus was at absolute max capacity. We were sheltering 356 guests every night, up from 280 guests when we opened in 2017. And it's really important to know 1 in 5 were over the age of 55. That rapid increase in people needing help required more resources than we could provide. Part of that challenge is because public investments in emergency shelters have been inadequate for years, forcing us and others like us to rely on private funding and emergency reserves at an unsustainable rate. For example, the Opportunity Center at our Dorothy Day campus is where meals are served, healthcare is provided, and case managers can work with people experiencing homelessness to find housing and services. Many assume that this is a publicly funded operation, but the reality is that private funders, foundations, and critical reserves are paying for more than 90% of the costs of that Opportunity Center, which is not sustainable and something we ask this committee to understand more and to support more public investment. The pandemic has put an even greater strain and demand on our services. And I just want to share that our frontline staff have just worked tirelessly through it all. We've fully revamped our food service. We've implemented upgraded hygiene and social distancing protocols. We've worked with county partners to decrease the census at our shelters and to move guests into safe alternatives. You name it, we've done it. And never has it been clearer how much a part of our shelters play a role in our healthcare system. At Catholic Charities, our staff screen more than 1,600 adults and children each day across all of our sites, screen them for signs of COVID. Our staff are frequently the first point of referral for those requiring additional treatment for COVID. They've also played a critical role in contact tracing and coordinating testing events to prevent community spread. They literally stand alongside registered nurses to assist with intake at every testing event at our sites. I have even done this and am signed up to do some more again over the next couple of weeks. And as we continue to move forward, vaccine events. The COVID has just really reiterated how much shelters and day services are on those front lines. During the pandemic, state and federal emergency relief, for which we are incredibly grateful, was funneled through the Emergency Services Program to help providers cover these needs. These investments have saved lives, and we know more will be needed to support the long, long response throughout the coming months. And what's needed is a more sustainable state investment to support this work long-term. And with that, Catholic Charities is advocating this year in partnership with Homes for All and Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless for a $15 million biennium ongoing investment in the Emergency Services Program and for additional COVID relief to support shelter providers in this important work. We're very grateful for members of this committee who are supporting this effort. We also must do more to help individuals move out of shelter and into stable housing. Housing support, as I mentioned earlier, is a state program that is already really well established with proven results for housing stability, and it's been invaluable during COVID. By increasing the housing support base rate payment and revisiting some of its policies, we can make this program work better for even more residents and landlords. We really look forward to discussing these ideas more with you in the coming weeks as well. So I'll just conclude, Madam Chair, by saying that Catholic Charities, as a service provider for emergency shelters and really valuing housing support. I mean, we know that these programs save and strengthen lives by providing pathways to stable and affordable housing. And the need for their services will not go away when the pandemic ends. This is recognized across the state, with these programs being a priority focus for Homes for All and several organizations, including groups who are with us today. We ask for you to take this session as an opportunity to invest in this work and those most in need, and we really look forward to continuing the conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you. To clarify one thing, I had been referring to that new facility as Higher Ground, but you referred to it today as Dorothy Day.
Oh, you know what? I really appreciate that, Madam Chair. The whole campus is identified as Dorothy Day Place, and then the entities on the campus do have different names, both for the programs, you know, happening there, and so people can get around. But then honestly, because of the funding mechanisms are so complicated, they all have different names for legal reasons. So, yes, Higher Ground is where the shelter is at, and that's absolutely an appropriate name.
And I understand that it is named that because of the concept. By the way, members, this shows the difference that a new building can make. The old shelter, it divided men and women with a row of chairs, as I recall. There was a row of chairs down the center of the room with women on one side. Now, women have a room, a separate room, and men have a separate room. So a new building can provide a little more dignity in terms of your living arrangements. But my understanding is that the concept of Higher Ground was the first floor is basic shelter. It's that overnight shelter when you have no place to go. And then as their lives begin to stabilize and they're able to, perhaps they've gone back to work or they can afford, that they move up to a second floor where there are rooms, that everybody has their own room where they can stay. They don't have to leave in the morning. And then as it stabilizes even more, they can move to the third and fourth floor where there are apartments. I don't know if that concept is still.
Yes. Yep, absolutely. You're referring to our pay for stay program. For people who do have a little more stability and they, before COVID, we suspended the program right now because most people lost their jobs, but people would pay $6 a day and they would get back all of that money up to $500 or $600 to help with their down payment on a different location or et cetera. I mean, so to be able to help a person, but it does provide more space and privacy. It's a lot of shift workers, and so it's just as a quiet place to be versus with shelter having to secure your space.
Thank you. Mr. Wirth, do we have questions?
Madam Chair, Representative Howard has a question.
Representative Howard.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Underwood. I want to thank you and especially all the frontline workers that have worked tirelessly over this last year. And as you said, have undoubtedly saved lives. Just the fact that the data we have showing that only, and obviously any loss of life is terrible, but the fact that only, I believe it's 5 or 6 Minnesotans as part of our shelter system have died due to COVID speaks to the Herculean effort of so many. And so this question might be a little hard to answer, in that, you know, a lot of funds that were utilized to do this work have gone away for the most part. What do you think this last year would have looked like without those resources and without the emergency services program? And what could this system look like if we're not able to come up with permanent funding?
Ms. Underwood.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair and Representative Howard. That's a very powerful question, and you're right. Many of us will never ever forget when we learned from Mr. Eric Rumdahl about the first live lost from a person who was clearly experiencing homelessness, and it was only like late summer, early fall. I mean, we had made it so far. It was such a sad moment to learn that. So to answer your question, without the state support for the emergency services program, a lot of things would not exist right now. There would not be the ability for existing shelters to reduce their census so that clients and staff could be safe. And because I mentioned before, we were sheltering 356 adults a night. There is not 6 feet between adults. And if you've been to our site, there are nice bunks, but there's four bunks, you know, back to back. And to be safe, we needed to get down to at least half of that. And it was ESP, or Emergency Service Program dollars, that allowed partners, particularly for us, our counties, to work with hotels, which also needed income, to be able to move people, and particularly different vulnerable adult populations. Our homeless elders program has been in a hotel since late spring. So these are elderly seniors who are homeless that receive direct services. We were able to move people into hotels so that our own sites could get to a healthy census location, and individuals are still receiving life-saving services, while we have an opportunity to move people into something more stable. Of course, and you'll hear a lot about this with COVID, people aren't leaving apartments. I mean, there's not the flow happening. So without funding like ESP going well into the future, when COVID has a sense of subsiding for the typical population, we are going to have people who truly have nowhere to go, because how we've been supporting them has been on this bridge. And our commitment to go back to better, we are trying to get as many people into permanent housing as possible, and supporting the smaller other shelter locations that to last for as long as possible, because there's just not enough locations and opportunity for people to move into. So I'm not doing the best job answering your question. It's literally been life-saving, and if it goes away, people will literally not have anywhere to go, and we'll be in a worse case than before.
Follow-up, Roxanne Howard?
No follow-up, Madam Chair. I'll just thank you for the answer. And to put a finer point on it, it really is a matter of life and death that we continue this ESP program. And thank you for everything you've done and everything you will do this year. And hopefully we can have your back at the legislature this session. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I missed it to say earlier, through all of this and because of ESP, we haven't closed a single day. I can't speak for all of my shelter partners, but we have not closed a single day, and in many spaces have opened longer hours so that people have a safe place to be that offers some distance.
And I do hope when we can tour again that we can come to your place, because I think what you have done around the Opportunity Center also has been just amazing. And so I thank you very much for your work and for being with us today. Representative Howard, what occurs to me is, and here's another whole layer to this, is that as we talk about emergency shelters, that there are still barriers to the shelters that sometimes cause outcomes less desirable. I think the saddest story of last winter was a gentleman whose wife died, and so he had lost her, and he wanted to do a really nice funeral and memorial service for her, but that meant he spent his last savings, and he lost his house. So now he had lost his wife, and then he lost his house, and so he had no place to live, but he had a dog. And he had already lost his house and wife, and he didn't want to lose his dog, but he couldn't take the dog to the shelter. And so he lived in his car and subsequently lost both feet. That's the outcome. That's the sad outcome of what happens in this continuum when it doesn't work. So thank you very much, Ms. Underwood, for being with us. And members, I think I'll just close with a beacon story. When you are involved in all of these projects, you're invited to many groundbreakings and ribbon cuttings. And as a result, you get to hear the stories of the clients served by these projects. And there was a beacon project in the Midway area of St. Paul for homeless young people. And at the ribbon cutting, we heard the story, one of the young women who had found a place there, oh, I'm sorry, and there's nothing I can do to mute myself because I'm talking. So she told the story of she had, before she came to live here, she had undoubtedly lived on the light rail line or maybe with a friend, couch hopping, or perhaps even on the street. And then she talked about what it's like to suddenly have a room that has a door and she has the key. A room with a door, the door has a lock, and she has the key. And the life-changing thing that allows her to do. And the very first thing she wants to do once she's stabilized is to find a job. And the services were right there in this particular location to help her do that. So they're life-changing in many ways. And sometimes there are sad stories at the end and sometimes victories. And we just have to keep hoping for the victories. So thank you to everyone for our hearing today. Our next meeting will be Thursday, January 21st at 10:30, and we'll hear from the Department of Labor and Industries, the Met Council, cities around the state, and housing redevelopment officials, HRAs from around the state that play a role in housing development. Mr. Worth, do we have any additional questions? I should have checked with you once more.
Madam Chair, there is no one seeking recognition.
Okay. There being no other business before the committee, we are adjourned.